The following program is paid for by Absolute Mortgage, a division of Pinnacle Capital Mortgage Corporation. Absolute Mortgage Company, NMLS number 81395, and Washington CL number 81395, is an equal opportunity housing lender. Tina Mitchell, MLO number 145420, is a licensed loan originator with Absolute Mortgage. Visit AbsoluteLoans.com or call 888-90-HOMES for cost information.
You're listening to The Money Hour with your host, Tina Mitchell. Sponsored by Absolute Mortgage, a division of Pinnacle Capital Mortgage Corporation. Now, in the studio, local mortgage and finance expert, Tina Mitchell.
Welcome to The Money Hour at 1150 AM KKNW, the Saturday, October 24 show. I am your host and mortgage expert, Tina Mitchell. Every week I share expert advice and inside knowledge on today's events in our local economy and how it can affect your money. If you're hearing my show at a different time or day, you are listening to a rebroadcast, but I'm here to answer any questions or connect you with the awesome guests that I have in studio today. Please call the show at 1-855-400-1150. Again, that's 1-855-400-1150 or online at themoneyhour.com. And it is an awesome guest lineup today. I am the only girl in studio. I've got all men, so I'm excited. All different arenas. We've got estate planning, real estate, financial planning. Brad Van Vechten with Private Wealth Management Solutions. Investing in real estate may not produce a get-rich-quick results promised by many of the late-night information that you hear, but it can be one of the best investments your portfolio can have if you do it the right way. Also in studio, I have Glenn Price with Price and Farrington's Attorneys and Counselors at Law. You may ask why estate planning is a good thing to do. The answer is simple. Avoid probate, reduce estate taxes, avoid a mess, and protect your beneficiaries and protect your assets. Pretty important in estate planning arena. And last guest in studio, first time in studio, is Kurt Nystrand with Keller Williams Realty Bellevue. As a buyer in today's real estate market, it's pretty crazy with all the lack of, or I should say with the lack of inventory, not all the real estate properties. Being prepared will help you win in today's market. Great information and great guests in studio. As always, you can call the show at 1-855-400-1150. Again, 1-855-400-1150 or online at themoneyhour.com. Let's start out today with a little money chat.
Money. Money.
Today, I want to focus on any of you first-time home buyers out there today that are renting and looking at the possibility to get into home ownership. Take advantage of it. The interest rates are extremely low right now. We have not seen them go up quite yet, but they will. And today I want to share the Mortgage Credit Certificate, or MCC, through the Washington State Housing Finance Commission. It's a tax credit for first-time home buyers, 20% tax credit off of all of the interest you pay in your mortgage for the life of the loan, dollar for dollar. This is a credit, not a deduction. So let's use an example. If you had a loan amount of $400,000, let's just say interest rates today at 4%, which that's just hypothetical purposes only because it is based on a lot of different factors, but good estimate to go with for a 30-year fixed. You'd be looking at interest paid of $16,000 for the first year. Easy math, take 20% of that. That means you're going to save $3,200 on the taxes you would pay that you would not have to pay if you qualify for the MCC tax credit. Divide that by 12 months, it's $266 a month, or really what does this mean for you in buying power? An additional $40,000 to $50,000 increase in buying power. That can make a substantial difference in what you can get out in the real estate market today. Now, the $266 a month or whatever that savings you're going to receive can also be used to help qualify for a higher purchase price as well. So if you're hitting a maximum amount of what you can approve for, the MCC tax credit, mortgage credit certificate can help you qualify for more. Now, how you see that money actually on a monthly basis is consult with a licensed CPA or your accountant. Find out how to amend your W-4 with your employer once you own your home so that you can see that money in your paycheck rather than waiting to the end of the year to receive those benefits. It doesn't matter how you're filing your deduction. Of homeownership is based on whether you file standard or not, but the tax credit is going to be there. If you pay enough income taxes, if you pay at least $3,200 in income taxes for that year, you're going to receive a $3,200 discount in taxes you'd have to pay, which means that you'd break even. So it's not like the deduction. It doesn't matter how you file. It's a dollar for dollar credit based on the income taxes you would have otherwise had to pay. Again, seeing it in your monthly paycheck on a monthly basis is just amending your W-4. Now, the tax credit is, again, not replacing the deduction, but in addition to. It's not a loan program, but a tax credit, which means that it'll apply to any of the loan programs you choose to go with. FHA, conventional USDA, VA financing, all the different options, 30-year fixed, adjustable rate mortgage, as long as your lender participates in the MCC program, so you're the tax credit, which you need to make sure that they do. It can also be used with down payment assistant program, which I want to talk about now. The grant that I'm going to talk about is actually not through the Washington State Housing Finance Commission. They do have down payment assistance as a second mortgage, which means you need to pay it back. But if you can qualify for an actual grant, the grant means that you actually do not have to pay it back. So there's a great grant that's available through National Home Buyer Fund. Grant meaning not paying it back. It is, so it's not a second mortgage. It's at a 0% interest rate, which means there's no payment either. So it truly is just free money that's being applied towards your down payment. It's based at 5% of your loan amount. So if you were doing a low down payment at 3.5% down, the 5% is going to cover the down payment, plus a little bit can go towards your closing cost and prepaids. You do not have to be a first-time home buyer to qualify. So if you're purchasing your second home, that's totally fine. You just have to be buying it as an actual primary residence. Now, it does have an income limit. The income restriction is $97,000 a year. So this is based for people that are in a lower bracket of income. But what you can do is if you have a significant other or a spouse that's going to be on the loan with you, if combined together, the two of you make more than $97,000, leave one of you off the loan. That would be acceptable if the other person that's on the loan makes less than $97,000. So it's not a household income, but it's the income that's based on the loan application. There is no recapture tax. It means you don't have to pay anything back when you sell your home. And there's no limits to assets of what you actually have in your account. So if you want to utilize this and keep your own money, as long as you meet the income requirement, then you're fine. You also can get your earnest money back at closing. So it's a really great way to get into a home using the combination of the MCC Mortgage Credit Certificate Tax Credit, which is for first-time home buyers, and using the grant program as well to help you with the down payment. Now, I didn't mention the income restrictions on the MCC, being because that's going to be based on county versus the grant program. It's just a straight $97,000. Anywhere you're purchasing in Washington, it doesn't matter. But on the MCC tax credit, it's based on the county that you're actually purchasing in. It's also based on the number of people that are in your household. So just giving one example here, one to two persons in your household, that's $90,000. If you have a baby, it would put you to a three-person household. That would take it up to $97,000. The income restrictions go down in some of the other counties. But again, it's a great way to get into a home. First-time home buyer for the tax credit. Why would you not use it if you make that under that income limit? And then those of you, even if it's not a first-time home buyer, if you want to take advantage of some grant funds that you don't have to pay back, pretty awesome. If you have any questions, give the show a call at 1-855-411-50. Again, 1-855-411-50. Coming up next on the Money Hour, do you have extra funds to invest? If you do, what asset class options do you have to invest in? Brad Van Vectrum with Private Wealth Management Solutions, right here on 1150 AM KKNW after this short break.
The 1,200,000 women and men of Rotary have accomplished extraordinary things. They've taught millions of people to read, worked toward world peace, and have nearly eradicated a crippling childhood disease from the face of the planet. But each of those 1,200,000 women and men know they could accomplish so much more if only they were 1,200,001. Find out what an impact one person can make. Learn about Rotary at Rotary.org.
This is the Money Hour with your host, Tina Mitchell, on Alternative Talk, AM 1150. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance expert, Tina Mitchell.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with your host and mortgage expert, Tina Mitchell, right here on 1150 AM KKNW, this Saturday, October 24th show. I am dedicated to my listeners, providing you with the best tools needed to make informed decisions on all matters when it affects your money. If you're hearing my show at a different time or day, you are listening to a rebroadcast, but I'm always here to answer any questions or connect you with the guests that I have in studio today. You can call the show at 1-855-400-1150. Again, that's 1-855-400-1150 or online at themoneyhour.com. And back in studio again, we have Brad Van Vechten with Private Wealth Management Solutions. And Brad, I'm excited to talk to you today. Our topic is going to be about investing in real estate. And I know in your arena, there's a lot of different asset classes that you can invest in. So it'll be interesting to hear your spin on real estate. Thank you so much for coming back in studio. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And a little background about Brad. Bradley is an independent fee-only and certified financial planner. He's been helping individual families and small business owners identify and achieve their financial goals for over 20 years. He works with his clients personally to understand their needs, map out their cohesive strategies, and provide ongoing guidance to help them succeed as an investor. His professional credentials include certified financial planner, certified investment management analyst, chartered life underwriter, chartered financial consultant, and Brad is founder of Private Wealth Management Solutions based in Bellevue, Washington, state registered investment advisor. So Brad, let's go ahead and start out with what your thoughts are. If I have any listeners that are thinking of investing in our real estate market.
So hi, Tina. Your question's timely. For some reason, I've had a run of clients who are interested in buying real estate, so they asked me to run the numbers and offer my advice. From the point of view of a certified financial planner, the answer is it depends, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, is this going to be your principal residence? Is it rental property, commercial property? Can you comfortably afford to make the payments as well as fund your other long-term goals, you know, such as educating your kids or saving for retirement? Can you afford the maintenance, the insurance, and the taxes? Is it a place to live, or are you buying it just as an investment? Can you tolerate your neighbor or his kid parking a junk or a huge RV in the driveway in front of their house? You know, to be sure, real estate ownership is built into the American DNA, but it's definitely not for everybody. You know, to my surprise, though, it's a very emotional purchasing decision.
Mm-hmm. And so what surprises you when it comes to people purchasing real estate?
You know, that in some cases, no matter how compelling the evidence is against a real estate purchase, some clients still want to go ahead with it, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't make economic sense. So, you know, I understand that's a very powerful draw, particularly in this country.
So what about a primary residence? If you have a client that's coming in, or we've got somebody listening that's asking advice from a financial advisor side on purchasing a home primary, where are our benefits?
Well, the first is that no one can kick you out or raise your rent.
That's very true, and we've seen what rent has done.
And then secondly, in my opinion, a mortgage is really the only good debt because you can write off the interest you pay on the loan. You know, thirdly, once you establish some sort of equity, you can establish a home equity line of credit, otherwise mm-hmm. known as a HELOC, and, you know, borrow money on the equity in the property to educate your children and things like that. And then, very importantly, the use of leverage. And it's a beautiful thing when used properly. So, you know, for example, if you put down 10% on a $100,000 house, just to make the math easy,
mm-hmm.
and the value of the property goes up $10,000, you've made 100% return on your money.
Yes.
And that's a beautiful thing.
It is. And, you know, leveraging the equity in your home is a really great thing. Just like Brad says, is as long as you're careful in how you're doing that, you're making sure you're not leveraging too much. And that's what happened in the financial crisis is people leverage, but then they just let the properties go. And you've got to stick it out and wait for the appreciation to come back, because history will show that it typically always does. So what about multifamily, duplexes, fourplexes? What are your conversations there with your clients, Brad?
You know, what I see, the people that are successful doing that, Tina,
mm-hmm.
Are successful landlords, you know, generally the ones that maintain the properties themselves. If you're paying someone else to do the maintenance and so forth, that's going to erode, you know, your return on investment. So, generally speaking, those are the people working on it themselves that do well. And they hold the property a long time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're thinking of jumping in and out of rental real estate or multifamily homes, you're generally not going to be successful at it.
Yeah. And, you know, look at people that bought multifamily homes right at the height of the market. And, you know, rents went up like crazy. property values got back to where they were. And so many people let those multifamily properties go, which was so unfortunate because you just look at the rents and how quickly the rents appreciated or went up, regardless of the fact that the appreciation was going down. It wasn't money that you needed anyways. You just needed to hold on to that property. So, yeah, there's some great benefits there. So if we get into commercial real estate, which if you're listening and wondering what falls into commercial, it's anything that over 4 units is going to be your commercial real estate. So, Brad, what are your thoughts on investing in commercial real estate versus residential real estate?
The people I see that are successfully doing that generally occupy some space in the property themselves.
Okay.
You know, that way they can oversee what's going on, collect rents, those sorts of things. The people that don't succeed at it, I think, you know, are buying commercial property in Texas or some other place where, you know, they're really not, you know, seeing what's going on with the property and able to maintain it.
Okay. So, Brad, what if I have a listener that's listening, has got the benefit to be able to pay down their mortgage ahead? They've got some extra funds that they can work with to make additional payments. What are you advising there?
You know, honestly, this is going to be the most important part of our discussion today. You know, and the answer is generally no.
Yes.
Don't do it. Especially when, in your income-producing years where you can take advantage of the mortgage expense deduction. And secondly, while interest rates are so low.
Yes. And I always run that for my clients, and it's pretty surprising when you look at the cost of interest rate, and the true cost of interest rate is really after your tax bracket. So if you're in a 25% tax bracket and you've got a 4% interest rate, it really is 3.75% interest rate. So if you look at that, can you earn on your investment more than 3.75%? And I would imagine that there's probably something that you can invest in that's going to earn a higher return. Also, the fact that you're actually going to be able to compound and just looking at real estate's not based on what you owe. Real estate's based on the value of the property. It doesn't matter what you owe. So it's going to appreciate based on the value. Your asset class is going to appreciate based on how much you have in that asset. So if you're not investing into it. So when you look at the numbers, it's really easy to run them to see what makes most sense for you. Now, what about paying cash for a property? Oh, go ahead, Brad. What are you going to say on that?
I just want to interject. So, you know, generally paying off your mortgage before retirement is a very American notion, you know, for some reason that's been installed in us, you know, since we were children. But frankly, real estate's a lousy place to park your cash. Number one, it's illiquid. And it, as you already mentioned, it doesn't grow very quickly compared to other asset classes.
Exactly. Okay?
So to back that up, here's why. Inflation's 2.4% average over the last 20 years, right? Homes on average appreciate 3.2% nationally, about 1% over inflation.
Okay.
The United States stock market returns almost 10% a year average over the last 20 years, and a well-diversified portfolio of stocks, international bonds, alternatives, and international stocks returns about 9%. So my question is, why would you put, you know, the majority of your money in an asset class that just returns 3%, wouldn't you get 8 or 9? Not only that, those funds are immediately available, you know, if it's in an after-tax account, to you in the event you need them. And as an option, you can always use that money to pay back, to pay off the mortgage if that's what you want to do.
Yep. When it comes to how you want to manage your money, ultimately you are the decision maker as far as what makes you feel most comfortable for the security of your family. What you need to do is you just need to look at the numbers, because I think that's where a lot of people, they're just not looking at how the numbers come out. And you can look at the numbers and you've got the information to make the best decision again for you and your family. Now, what about paying cash for property? We may have people listening today that are downsizing, and so they've got the ability to go in and just completely pay cash for that home. What are your thoughts there?
So I would encourage them to pay a modest down payment, take out a low interest mortgage, and invest the difference conservatively. And keep your options open. You know, there's value in having options open to you. You can always change your mind in the future and pay off the mortgage. But in the meantime, you know, say you're in a diversified portfolio over 5 or 10 years, you're going to vastly out earn what it would be if that money were parked in a non-liquid asset such as real estate.
Yeah, makes total sense. So any other advice that you have to my listeners when considering purchasing real estate, Brad?
Consider, you know, what are the tax consequences? You know, if you need to sell it, what if you're underwater on the loan? These are all things that, you know, sometimes people get forced into, particularly if, you know, they jumped in when they shouldn't have, when they didn't have enough assets, as an example, to put down a meaningful down payment.
And I think people jumped in too, well, they jumped in when they weren't in a position to hold onto the property in a bad market. What you shouldn't have done is any of those strategic defaults, because now look where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. So if you buy real estate historically is an asset that you are not going to lose money if you're not forced to sell in a bad market. History of real estate shows that we always come back from a market where we've lost appreciation. So can you share what happens when selling real estate in Washington State, Brad?
I'm originally from California, so this was a bit of a surprise to me. So even if you lose money in the transaction in the state of Washington, you pay a real estate excise tax, mm-hmm. which starts at 1.28%. And then each city can add up to 0.5% on that. So, you know, total, you're paying an excise tax of somewhere around 1.75%. So on a $500,000 house, taxes amount to almost $9,000
yep.
when you sell the property. So people need to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure a lot of people are.
Got it. Yep. So really quickly, before I take it to Brank, Brad, what about reverse mortgage?
So a couple of quick thoughts there. They've evolved dramatically in the last 5 years. So in the event you've parked all your money in real estate mm-hmm. and you need to access it for whatever reason, these reverse mortgages have really been modified. And since the government got involved to protect the interest of the consumer, they're not a bad thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, to be honest with you, a year ago, I thought, you know, there's no way I would ever recommend these to my clients, but mm-hmm. They've become a wonderful tool. So as an example, you can borrow up to $625,000. It's an FHA insured loan.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing is that these days you don't have to pay the loan back, but if you want to, you can.
Yes.
So, you know, in the event the stock market's down and you don't, or the, you know, or bond market's down, you don't want to access that money, you can utilize these reverse mortgages, and then when the market returns, then sell, pay off the loan, and you're right back where you started.
Yep.
Here's the other nice thing. They can't be canceled or modified. And lastly, there's this huge misconception that banks can take your home, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's simply not true anymore.
Yeah. And I really don't think that there's a bad product out there. What's bad is not understanding how the product works to make sure it's the right product for you.
You even have to go through counseling these days.
You do. And the reverse mortgage is it's always been a good program. The problem was it was getting abused and how it was getting explained, and people didn't understand how it was working. So as long as you've got the right advice, and that's the reason that I'm here, that's the reason why the Money Hour is on air, is to make sure you've got the best experts in every arena regarding your financing to make sure that you understand what your options are. Brad, thank you so much for coming back in studio. It's always a pleasure to have a conversation with you, and I appreciate you sharing all your wealth of information with my listeners.
My pleasure, Tina.
Coming up next on the Money Hour, many people avoid estate planning because they think it focuses on death after funerals. Actually, it's the opposite. Estate planning focuses on life for your survivors after you die. Glenn Price and Price and Farrington, attorneys and counselors at law, right here on 1150 AM at KKNW after this short break.
Every day, more than 1.4 million American lives are disrupted by Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. This year alone, 70,000 new cases will be diagnosed, and more of those are children. Nearly 75% of patients with Crohn's disease will require one or more surgeries at some point in their lives. Those are the facts, but they don't speak to the daily realities of living with Crohn's or colitis. Excruciating pain, a lifetime of medication, and days when they can't even get out of bed. There's a good chance you know someone suffering with Crohn's or colitis. Someone like me. I'm Amy Brenneman, and I'm asking you to support the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America. CCFA was created to help millions of us cope and to find cures. Visit ccfa.org today to learn more, donate, or join an event. It's time to face the facts and reach out to help someone you know at ccfa.org.
This is the Money Hour with your host, Tina Mitchell, on Alternative Talk, AM 1150. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance expert, Tina Mitchell.
Welcome back to The Money Hour with your host and mortgage expert, Tina Mitchell, right here on 1150 AM KKNW, the Saturday, October 24th show. I build a network of elite industry professionals each week, sharing their knowledge and expertise to my listeners. If you're hearing my show at a different time or day, you are listening to a rebroadcast. To talk with the guest I have in studio today, you can call the show at 1-855-400-1150. Again, 1-855-400-1150 or online at themoneyhour.com. Back in studio again, Glenn Price with Price and Farrington Attorneys and Counselors at Law. Glenn, thank you for coming back in studio and visiting me.
Thank you for having me.
Excited to talk to Glenn about estate planning. Before we do that, a little background on Glenn. Educator, graduated of Harvard, the London School of Economics, and Duke Law School, and 39 years in legal practice. Glenn was named a superstar lawyer by Washington Law and Politics magazine and named a top estate planning attorney in 2013 in Seattle Magazine. Glenn has spoken throughout Washington at public and private estate planning events over the past 20 years and works closely with other professional advisors in serving clients' needs in estate, tax, retirement, asset protection, and family wealth planning. So Glenn, let's go ahead and start out with, what are some of the biggest estate planning mistakes that you see people making?
Well, where would you like me to start?
The biggest ones.
You know, there's a piece I wrote some time back that narrowed it down to three. The first mistake is failure to plan in the first place.
Yep.
The second mistake is failure to properly implement the plan you have in place. And the third major failure is failure to update that plan.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's kind of a shorthand way of saying those are the three biggest mistakes, but there are a lot of other mistakes people make. They will not coordinate their estate planning. Their wills will not be coordinated with beneficiary designations on IRAs or 401ks or life insurance policies. They'll fail to take advantage of trust planning for children or for folks who need assistance in money management or for asset protection planning. So there are all kinds of potential pitfalls and mistakes in the planning process.
And Glenn, a lot of people may think that estate planning is just about what happens when they die.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest myths and misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Because folks conceive of estate planning as being death planning. They tend not to get around to doing it.
Yes.
Because they go into denial. They know they're never going to die. It doesn't seem relevant to their everyday life. Estate planning is really much more than death planning. It's really lifetime incapacity and disability planning.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's planning for what happens when you're no longer around.
Yes.
But it's that first component, the lifetime planning, that is often overlooked, not implemented. And the will that you have in place doesn't do you any good if you run into problems while you're alive.
So, Glenn, what would be an example of that? Something that's going to come up with someone when they're alive and they don't have their estate plan together. Share a story of how that could really look for someone.
Well, take a small business owner, for example, who doesn't even have a financial power of attorney in place, who has a heart attack and is out of commission recovering for 4 months to 6 months. No one has legal authority to make decisions, to manage the business.
Mm-hmm.
To engage in any kind of financial transactions, because something as simple but as powerful as a financial power of attorney was never signed off by this gentleman or this business owner. That's a practical everyday problem with failure to plan.
Yeah, boy, that could definitely be devastating. What about the important documents for estate planning, Glenn? Can you share those with my listeners?
You know, there are five basic estate planning documents for starters that everyone should have. First, a death time planning document, be it a will or a revocable living trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are four critically important lifetime planning documents to go with that will. Number one, a financial power of attorney. Number two, a health care or medical power of attorney. Number three, a living will, which addresses the life support issue.
Yes.
And number four, the privacy authorization under HIPAA, which grants access to your private confidential medical information to the limited number of people who you wish to have access to it. Those five documents are real in some form or other.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone age 18 and over should have.
Wow. So, Glenn, doesn't your will control how your estate will pass on your death?
Your will controls the assets that it controls. There are a number of assets or forms of titling where the will doesn't come into play. And this is a common trap people fall into. Any asset that bears a beneficiary designation, be it a retirement plan, an IRA, a 401k, a 403b, a KEO plan, a life insurance policy, annuities of all different types, these are assets which will pass by operation of law to the designated beneficiary. The will does not govern or control that asset. Another common example of how assets transfer outside of your will is by the form of titling of that asset. Joint tenancy with right of survivorship ownership is a very common form of ownership of a piece of real estate or a checking account or bank account or brokerage account. By operation of law, the surviving joint tenant or tenants automatically come into title ownership of that asset upon death. Whatever provisions you have in your will regarding how you would like assets to transfer, do not reach that joint tenancy with right of survivorship asset. So you can undermine your own planning sometimes if you haven't coordinated beneficiary designations with asset titling with the terms of your will.
So, Washington Community Property, someone may think that this means that their surviving spouse automatically inherit their estate. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, this is a real common myth. Mm-hmm. The belief that in Washington State, if you are married, the law means automatically that the community property you own at the time of your death, meaning essentially 50% of the estate, automatically must go to the surviving spouse. The reality is that you control your community property. Your community property can be directed to whomever, whatever beneficiaries you wish at the time of your death. Now, under Washington law, the surviving spouse will have a right to a certain amount, a certain dollar value of the decedent's estate under what's called the homestead exemption. Okay. But it's not all that large a figure. So community property is controlled by the decedent in the decedent's planning documents at the time of death. Typically, the surviving spouse is the primary beneficiary, but the law doesn't mandate that that happen.
Got it. Well, I sure better be on mine.
Now, Tina, if you die intestate, if you die without a will or without having done any meaningful estate planning, the default in Washington is that community property will transfer to the surviving spouse.
Got it. Okay. So, Glenn, do you have any of your clients go, you know what, trust her for just the wealthy people? How would you answer that?
This, again, is one of the most common misconceptions people have. If you're not a Bill Gates or a Steve Ballmer, or for the older generation listening out there, the Rockefellers or Kennedys or DuPonts, that a trust isn't relevant. And really, a trust is a tool that allows assets to be managed, held, protected, and distributed out over time for all kinds of reasons, for all kinds of beneficiaries. A beneficiary who cannot handle money, a special needs beneficiary, minor children. Trust can be used for asset protection purposes. Trust can be very, very effective wealth transfer techniques where you, over time, gift assets into the trust for the benefit of folks named as beneficiaries in that trust down the road, and you are meanwhile removing from your taxable estate all of the assets that you've transferred into that trust, including the growth over time in those assets. And of course, trust can be used for estate tax planning and for all kinds of charitable or philanthropic planning. So the correlation between wealth and whether trust planning is appropriate for you is not really a direct correlation.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit on probate?
Well, probate is a process. It's not, unlike what many people think, a tax.
Okay.
Probate is a court-supervised administration of your estate under Washington law. Every state has some form of probate. And the primary purposes for probate at time of death are, number one, to make sure that asset titling transfers properly from the person who died to the survivors or the beneficiaries. And number two, probate is intended to make sure that creditors who are owed money, who have legal debts that they're entitled to have repaid, get paid. Those are really the two primary purposes historically for probate: proper title transfer and paying creditors.
Washington State real estate taxes. Washington State estate taxes. Can you talk about those, Glenn?
Washington State is one of 16 or 17 states that has a standalone state estate tax. This is a tax that is levied by the state, the Department of Revenue, on the net fair market value of your estate as of date of death. Now, for a married person, that means the net fair market value of the decedent's community property ownership. It doesn't mean 100% of the estate. It means the 50% or the community property that the owner controlled at time of death. Under current law in Washington, every individual can protect a little over $2 million as of the date of their death before Washington state estate taxes will be imposed. If married couples do smart, basic estate tax planning, as a couple, they can protect a little over $4 million in the year 2015 under Washington law.
Wow.
The amount that can be protected, the exclusion amount as it's called, is gradually increasing annually under Washington law. That in a nutshell is how
it works. Okay, all right. So for my listeners, giving them advice on how often they should update their estate plan, what would you say?
Well, you know, you maintain your automobile from time to time to make sure it's running properly. With estate planning, it's a little more of a challenge because as long as your planning is current, that is, reflects the goals and circumstances in your life, that planning may survive for a long time and still be valid and still be appropriate for you. We have many clients who begin tweaking and amending, revisiting their estate planning within 6 months of doing the planning initially because events are occurring in their lives, be it a birth or a death or dramatic change in wealth, that impacts the planning they put in place. So each person wants to periodically review their estate planning, maybe once a year, just to make sure it still continues to reflect where they are and what their goals are.
So any special event happens in interim, do that. Otherwise, once a year is a good time to have it checked. As your host, I advise you not to go through the inexpensive way of setting up your estate plan online. Glenn, help me out here.
Yeah, you know, it's like going to Ace Hardware to buy a pair of pliers because you need to have some teeth work done. I mean, it's just, you can try to do it on your own. Susie Orman is a business lady and a very successful one, but she doesn't particularly care about your individual circumstances and your estate planning, nor is she going to be waiting on the other end of the phone when your survivors, your children, your beneficiaries call her to find out what went wrong or to have questions answered. You want to have a relationship with an estate planning attorney who is there to put a proper plan together, there to provide ongoing guidance while you're alive, and there for your surviving spouse or children or other beneficiaries when you're gone, so that things are done the right way.
Makes sense. Got less than a minute really quickly. LLC for real estate. Good idea?
Well, a limited liability company is an asset protection planning tool.
Yes.
And for folks who have rent-paying tenants in numerous rental units, they're operating a business. And in any business, liability can occur through accidents, injuries. And if you hold title to real estate in your own name, everything you own may be subject to a judgment that's returned against you for liability that occurred on the premises of a property you own. If you own the property in a limited liability company, you're controlling, you're limiting, you're compartmentalizing the damage that can be done to the value of the asset in the limited liability company. You are insulating everything else you own, your home, your brokerage account, everything you have.
Great advice. Glenn, thank you so much for joining me again back in studio. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And coming up next in the Money Hour, how a buyer should navigate through today's real estate market. Kurt Nystrand with Keller Williams Realty Bellevue, right here at 1150 AM, KKNW, after the short break.
The The University of Washington Parent-Child Study is looking for parents and their 8 to 11-year-old children to participate in a 3-hour research study examining how children learn to distinguish between what is safe and what is not safe. They're especially interested in how those processes differ in children of parents with and without post-traumatic stress disorder. Parents are compensated with up to $60, and all children are given a UW Child Scientist t-shirt. In addition, all parents receive a thorough psychiatric evaluation. For more information, please call Alyssa at 206-685-9043 or visit online parentchildstudy.com. That's 206-685-9043 or parentchildstudy.com.
This is the Money Hour with your host, Tina Mitchell, on Alternative Talk, AM 1150. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance expert, Tina Mitchell.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with your host and mortgage expert, Tina Mitchell, right here on 1150 AM KKNW, the Saturday, October 24th show. I'm empowering our community, providing you with opportunities and solutions when it comes to your money. If you're hearing my show at a different time or day, you are listening to a rebroadcast. You can call the show at 1-855-400-1150. Again, 1-855-400-1150, or go online to themoneyhour.com. First time in studio, excited to talk with you today, Kurt. I have Kurt Nystrand with Keller Williams Realty Bellevue. As a buyer in today's real estate market, it's pretty crazy out there with the lack of inventory. Being prepared on exactly how to navigate through the process is important if you want to win in today's market. So, Kurt, thank you again for coming into studio.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tina.
And a little background on Kurt. Kurt has served in the real estate industry since 2005 and with Keller Williams Realty since early 2009 and represents both buyers and sellers with their continuous goal of meeting and exceeding his clients' expectations. Kurt has experienced negotiating contracts and representing clients so that their best interest is served. He has earned the Certified Negotiation Expert, Accredited Buyer Representative, Certified Real Estate Analyst, and Certified Short Sale Negotiator designation to represent and negotiate the buyers and sellers. Customer satisfaction, Kurt's number one priority, and is his honor to represent his clients with honesty and integrity throughout the real estate experience. His goal is to listen to each person he works with in effort to learn more about their unique situation and help them through the next step. Additionally, Kurt is an official trainer for the Washington State Housing Finance Commission and co-teach homebuyer education classes with lenders for people interested in learning more about what they should know before buying a home. One thing I talked in Money Chat is the mortgage credit certificate, grant programs that are available, which you need to go to these certified classes and lenders and realtors teach. So, Kurt, thank you for giving back there to our community. So let's go ahead and start talking about multiple offer scenario, because I think everybody in, at least in the popular areas in our market, are in multiple offers. So with preparing your clients for multiple offers, what are you doing, Kurt?
Well, really, ideally, preparation is the key on that. And I always recommend that the buyer sits down with their agent and has a buyer's consultation with them. And a lot of things happen there. You get to know your agent better, your agent gets to know you better and what your needs are. And then I like to go over general things that will be taking place throughout the process to try to eliminate as many surprises as possible. Things like how much earnest money should they offer, or how much does an inspection cost, and give them an opportunity to review contracts ahead of time and things along those lines.
All important to make sure that they're completely prepared to win in a multiple offer scenario. So, Kurt, as a real estate agent, how important is it for their agent to actually pick up the phone and have a conversation with the listing agent prior to presenting that offer?
I think it's huge. I think it can be the difference in some cases on whether you get chosen or not. Basically, what the goal is when you're calling the other agent is to try to find out what's important to the seller. Mm-hmm. And price, obviously, is often the first thing that's mentioned. But price isn't always the thing that makes a difference between an offer being chosen or not. For example, in some cases, sometimes the assumption is that short closing, the quicker you can close, the better your chance of getting the home. Well, if that seller is looking to purchase their own home, 2-week close might scare the willies out of
them. Yes.
Yeah, and so they might prefer a 45 or even a 60-day close. And so if that's an option for your buyer, then knowing that, again, can make a huge difference. In some cases, too, especially if they are looking at buying their next home, sometimes being able to stay in the home after closing for a couple days for that transition could be very helpful also. And so as many of those things that you can get in, get straightened out before you even send your offer over, then the greater chance of them choosing yours.
It's such important advice, and there's so many things that are going on during the real estate process. Having a realtor that's taking the extra time to do the things that are necessary, because just like you said, it can be a complete disaster if you don't prep and understand exactly what that seller needs. So what about a buyer, Kurt? Are you advising your buyers to put together personal letter? I've heard it be called the love letter to the seller. Or what kind of advice do you have on that?
Yeah, you know, in general, I think it can make the difference. However, you also have to be very careful in how you're doing it. You can't violate fair housing and go into familial status and stuff like that. However, it can be an opportunity to try to connect with the seller. And recently, I was actually in a class, and I thought the teacher gave some good advice. He basically said, as you're going through the home, pay attention to what's on the walls, what's in the garage and stuff. And for example, maybe they have pictures in the hallway about their trip to Paris, or you go into the garage and they have motorcycles in there, or classic cars or something like that. And one example of that is recently I was helping a couple look for home, and we went into this one home that they wanted to pursue. And we noticed two specific things while we were there. Number one, when you went into the man cave area, so to speak, they had this kind of like a street sign up above the door that said like Seahawks Lane or something like that. So obviously, or apparently, they were Seahawks fans.
Yes.
And then the second thing is we went into the garage, and he had, the seller had a Mustang in the garage. And to be honest with you, it didn't really strike me as any type of a fancy car. It looked dusty, looks like it had been there forever, barely worked on. But oftentimes when people have Mustangs, they, sometimes they're collectors or something like that. And so in their letter, they brought up a few things. They talked about, hey, we saw your sign about the Seahawks. And he started talking about how he had been a fan for the last 20 years and he went through the bad years. And so he's really enjoying the Super Bowl run. And and then they talked about how they loved how big the garage was. And they summed it up in a very few, just a few words, and said, oh, and by the way, nice Mustang. And they capitalized Mustang.
Nice.
And so, and through that, there were multiple offers in this situation, and we were the ones that were chosen, and they ended up closing, and the agent mentioned to me that one of the things that they really enjoyed was the letter that they'd written, because they really
and
related
it makes,
to it.
It makes total sense, because you're connecting with, on an emotional letter, emotional level with a seller, and when somebody's selling their house, there's a lot of emotions involved in doing that, so being able to connect there. And as Kurt said, just in the advice, it's not writing about you and your family and your children, because that's where you can get into that area that could be a problem. It's making it about the seller and making comments on everything that's important to the actual seller of that home. Awesome advice. What about shortening any terms in the contract? What can you assist with there in our buyers?
Yeah, you know, that, again, can be another very large piece to the puzzle when there's multiple offers. And one example could be on, if you're using the typical contracts for an offer on the inspection contingency, the default time period is 10 days. And most buyers love that because they've got plenty of time to do the inspection and they can sleep on it for multiple days and so forth. For the seller, though, they're on pins and needles because if a deal falls apart, they certainly can fall apart after the inspection is done, but the greatest likelihood is something goes wrong with the inspection. And so what I advise my clients is trying to shorten that period voluntarily when you submit your offer, where it's long enough so that you can get a good inspector out there, but it might take calling a few to see what their schedules are and such. However, not so long again that there's a balance in there. So usually at least between 5 to 7 days is often plenty of time to get somebody out there to get a good inspection and decide what the response will be. If it's a really competitive scenario, gosh, if you can get that down to 2 or 3 days, that would be even more ideal, as long as the buyer, the other side of that coin is the buyer also needs enough time to do their due diligence also, of course.
Of course. Yeah. And on the buyer's side, I mean, it's getting more critical right now with TRID and the new timelines that are coming in with the CFPB to really get that taken care of. So good advice there. Now, let's get into the pre-approval process and the importance of that, and also what your lender partner can do in helping with the buyer in a multiple offer arena?
Yeah, you know, with the lending and pre-approvals, one critical piece of that is doing your homework up front with your lender and getting a good local lender who you trust, who can take care of you, and then turning everything in as quickly as you can to them so that they can do their job to get you fully pre-approved. The one thing I've learned on the, especially on the listing side, is not every pre-approval letter is equal to the other.
Yes.
And if the listing agent is, in my opinion, doing their job and representing their client well, then once they receive your offer, whether there's a multiple offer or not, then they should be calling the lender, introducing mm-hmm. themselves, saying, hey, great, I got this offer from your client.
Yep.
And tell me where we're at. And they may ask, gosh, did they turn in their all their tax records? Have they mm-hmm. turned in their last two pay stubs and the bank records and so forth? And empowering your, if you can empower your lender to brag about you,
yes,
then that can completely set you apart. Whereas if you're the listing agent's calling them up and the lender's hemming and hawing or, you know, trying to change the subject or whatever, then obviously, or they just tell them, no, gosh, they haven't turned that in yet, then the likelihood of you being chosen is very small.
Yep. And maybe even a little extra on top of that is, as a lender, you know, pick up the phone, call the listing agent before they call you and let them know, hey, I've just got your offer. Congratulations. My buyer's just submitted an offer. Congratulations. I work with Kurt on this, just to let you know that they're good to go, completely pre-approved. Oh, by the way, to look at my guarantee on my closing on the second page. Okay, that was a shout out for me because I do guarantee my closing.
Nice.
So whatever that you have to offer is making that call before they call you. Now, what about if I've got somebody listening to the show right now that is going, you know what, I'm just going to present a lowball offer, Kurt, and, you know, get some negotiation going on here. How do you deal with that comment?
Yeah, you know, if there's no other offers out there, you might be successful in getting a response still. Although, honestly, even if there's no offers, if you're too low, mm-hmm. you might just make them mad and they yep. don't call at all.
Yes.
So there's certainly balance in there. But if you understand that there are multiple offers, realistically, most, I think human nature-wise, we're drawn to the path of least resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've got, let's say, five offers to choose from, one of them is under list, maybe even way under list, and the rest of them are over, then especially usually the seller and their agent picks the one that fits their criteria the most,
yes.
that gives them the most price at the best mm-hmm. terms. And there might maybe 90% of it is what they want, and maybe they just want to adjust, you know, one or two items on there. That's the agent that they're going to be calling. Whereas the other four often don't get the phone call until either yes. late that night or the next day saying, sorry, someone else was chosen. So.
Yeah. The worst mistake that you can make is not understand how the process really is working. And you understand what you're really negotiating. Every $1,000, a little bit less than $5 a month in your payment. So do you want to get into a home in this market or not? You've got to really go in and be prepared and present your best offer up front, as Kurt said. Unless there's not multiple offer scenario, you might have a little room, but not seeing a lot of that right now. What about the inspection response? Can you talk a little bit on that, Kurt?
Yeah, you know, I basically, when I'm helping my clients, I recommend that once the inspection is done, taking a look at the whole inspection report and focusing, if you're going to ask the seller to fix something, focusing on a few items that are basically health and safety items,
mm-hmm.
really important things that if they're not changed, you probably don't want to buy it anyways. I've been on the listing side of a situation like that where we've received an inspection response. One of them, I think, had 20 or 21 items on it. And my jaw almost hit the ground. My first comment when I called my seller was, please don't shoot the messenger. It's just my job to tell you about this. You know, my thought was, they're just going to get mad and not do
yeah.
anything.
Uh-huh.
The funny thing was, at least funny on our side, they decided to look on this as like the country buffet. It's like, wow, we've got 20 items to choose from. Let's pick the top two or three.
And that's awesome.
One of them on there was literally a burnout light bulb.
Uh-huh.
Where I'm looking at that going,
gosh.
You've got to be kidding me. And they looked at it like, yeah, burnout light bulb, that'd be great. What, a couple bucks down
sure,
the store?
We'll pick
and
that one.
The electrical items on there, no, those are too expensive. And so they picked three or four things. And I think the buyer thought that they could, you know, basically let go of the light bulb for the higher, uh-huh. you know, the more important items. And their agent tried to say, hey, look, these are the ones that are most important. But again, the process is the seller can pick any ones they want. And so trying to keep to the most important items.
Yep.
And keeping it simple is the best way to go.
Makes total sense. Single family home, condo.
Yes. I think generally if somebody can afford a single family home, in general terms, they usually appreciate at a higher rate or faster rate than a condo. Though condos also can and certainly do go up. But there's also some less risks with with condos, you have HOAs and you have risk of special assessments and such. And so I would tend to advise more towards the or favor the single family if they can afford to do that.
Yeah, and lenders have a higher interest rate for condo than single family home because it is a higher risk of default. Sellers listening, we've got just a second before I've got to wrap us up here. Maximize their returns. What's advice do you have there, Kurt?
Yeah, you know, I go with the old saying, you only have one chance to make a first impression, or the good first impression. And so once you sit down with your agent and you're figuring out what to do, some general items are declutter the home. You're going to be moving anyways, and so the more you can, you're going to be packing everything up. And so the more the items that you don't need to have in there every day, that you can box those up and get into storage, and it just helps the house present better. If you can stage it, that's ideal, whether it's with your furniture or bringing in some furniture from a stager. And once you get the house ready to go and the exterior is done, I highly, highly recommend getting a professional photographer out there.
Yes.
Because the first impression these days is usually on the internet when people are clicking through pictures. And if you don't grab their attention on the first go, you're probably going to lose them, and the likelihood of them coming back is really low.
Yep, they'll hit delete, and then you'll never show up in the search criteria again. So that would be pretty bad. Kurt, thank you so much. It was great having you in for the first time. Look forward to having you back. Great advice for my buyers and for my sellers. Just really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tina.
And this is your host, Tina Mitchell, signing off for the day. I will be back same time, same place next Saturday right here on 1150 AM KKNW. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, everyone. Thanks.
The preceding program is paid for by Absolute Mortgage, a division of Pinnacle Capital Mortgage Corporation. Absolute Mortgage Company, NMLS number 81395, and Washington CL number 81395, is an equal opportunity housing lender. Tina Mitchell, MLO number 145420, is a licensed loan originator with Absolute Mortgage. Visit absoluteloans.com or call 888-90-HOMES for cost information.